Today I am going to start by briefly interrupting our regularly scheduled programming by telling you a true story, an account I came across looking on the web, I think this morning or yesterday, that it seems to me should both be of interest to you because it's about prosecutorial misconduct in Santa Clara County, and which I think illustrates why the general idea of this course, of teaching lawyers to sort of think in quantitative ways, a little bit more like mathematicians and economists, might actually be useful. The particular story involves the following, which has apparently been going on for several years and has just stopped. The police have a crime and a suspect, and they've got fingerprints. They have two fingerprint examiners examine the suspect's fingerprints and the crime scene fingerprints and say whether there's a match. If both examiners agree that there's a match, then they report to the court that there's a match. If the two examiners disagree, if one says there's a match and the other says, I can't tell if there is or not, they bring in a third person. And if the third one agrees there is a match, what they report to the court is two examiners agreed there was a match. They did not report either to the court or to the defense attorney that the third examiner said there wasn't. All right? And it is generally agreed this does not meet legal requirements. I think it's over this that one prosecutor has apparently been disbarred for 3 years, if I correctly followed the news story. It occurred to me, however, there's a question that people who are interested in this ought to be asking. And that is, of the cases where they brought in a third person, how many times did he confirm the match and how many times did he deny it? Because after all, if two experts disagree, that suggests the third person should have about a 50-50 chance either way, that it's an iffy kind of case.
Can we stop on the 50-50 there? Instead of two people already agreed?
Disagree.
Already disagreed, and it's a 50-50 chance.
That suggests the third one, yeah, at least from that sample, yep.
In this scenario, does the third person that come in know whether the person disagrees?
The third person only comes in if the first two disagree.
Well, yeah, but does he have to be?
Yes, he's a different person. He's a supervisor. Yes, at least from this is a Mercury News story that I found on the web, so I don't guarantee it's all true, but let's assume it's true because it easily could be. All right, so he knows. They did not keep records, so all you could do is interrogate the guy and ask him. But if you ask him, you know, of the times when you were called in, you know, about how often did you decide that they'd made a mistake and it wasn't a match, and how many times did you imagine if his answer was, oh, it was always a match, or practically always a match. At that point, I think it goes from being a violation of legal ethics to perjury. Because at that point, we know the third guy is really a rubber stamp. All right, that if it's really true that almost always he confirms where the other two people have disagreed, that's strong evidence that his implicit instructions are, we want convictions if one of our guys thought. And at that point, when they are saying two people agreed, what they really mean is either two people agreed or two people disagreed. So it just struck me as a case where if you were an attorney somehow involved in this, and I don't know what litigation will come out of it, it ought to occur to you to ask that question. And since I just discussed it with somebody who I have reason to suspect is attorney involved, and clearly the idea had not occurred to that person, it seemed to me a case where the way of thinking that we're looking at here actually makes a contribution to thinking about new law cases. So it's got nothing particularly to do with price theory or economics that we're discussing today, but since it just came up, I thought it was a neat example. All right? So before I go on, do you have questions on what we did last time? Let me suggest as a general rule that if questions occur to you after one class, it's worth having sort of organized them before the next, because otherwise I'll just start talking and it's hard to stop. All right, summary so far. Start out with what is economics, and in my view at least, economics is the way of understanding behavior that starts by assuming rationality and applies it to everything in sight, more or less. And we see whether it works, and if it doesn't work, try something else. But the claim, at least, is that it ends up working for many more things than one might expect. If this were a price theory course, I would explain about rational genes and so forth. But one of the things that economics points us at is what economists call the coordination problem. The fact that a functional society of any real size is an enormously complicated interrelated system where everything that everybody does depends on lots and lots of other people doing the right things, and that at first glance it's obviously impossible for it to work, and therefore we've all starved to death long ago. And yet it turns out it does work, and that there are basically two approaches to how we solve the problem. The one which works for small groups but not large groups is the centralized control. Somebody says, all right, in order to do this, you do this, you do that, you do that. And the one that works on a large scale in different variants, I'm not claiming they're all identical, is some sort of a decentralized property trade kind of model, where there's a certain little bit of the world I control, a little bit of the world you control. If you want something from my bit, you make an offer to me. If I want something from your bit, I make an offer. And that way, each individual person is solving a human-scale problem. You know, how do I cut down trees in my forest? How do I get grain out of my field? How do I teach people law and economics, or whatever, rather than trying to do the whole coordination? And then the interrelation is really handled by the price system, where if people need more iron ore to make steel to make cars, the price of iron ore goes up. That signals the mines that it's worth trying harder to produce iron ore. And, you know, the full version of that is a semester or two of price theory, and I'm not going to try to do it, but basically it works out as a system in which, as long as nothing mess ups the works, and some of the things that mess up the works are things like human ignorance and error and such, it doesn't require an external messing up. But that at least in the sort of simple model where each person is doing his bit right, as it were, that gives you a full coordination. It gives you the same result you would get if you had a perfectly wise central planner. And that's not obvious, and it's surprising, sort of one of the interesting things you get out of economics. And in particular, we have this concept of consumer and producer surplus, which turn out, I think, are non-obvious and very useful concepts. And the basic question is, if something changes in the system of prices that I'm facing, if automobiles get $1,000 cheaper, how much better off or worse off am I? Or $1,000 more expensive, or something else changes. And we'd like to be able to answer that question because there are lots of things such as a tax or a tariff which do change the prices of things. And so if somebody is saying, is it a good thing to have a tariff on automobiles? One way of putting that is, will the effect of a tariff on automobiles provide a benefit to producers of automobiles greater or less than the cost to consumers of automobiles? And you'd like, in principle, to think about other people affected as well. And to start answering that question, we need some way of judging when things change, how much better or worse off am I? And that's not obvious. So you know, you might say, well, how much more money are you spending? Well, suppose you had a tariff so high that I decided not to buy a car. I'm spending less money, and yet I'm obviously worse off, not better off, because without the tariff, I would have chosen to spend that money and get the car. So you need somehow some way of evaluating things which takes account both of the value of things to you and of the value to you of the money that you're, or whatever else you're giving up to get those things. And consumer and producer surplus are the economists' solution to this problem, figured out a little over a century ago by Alfred Marshall, one of the founders of modern economics. And the basic idea for consumer surplus is simple, once you see it, simple but not obvious. And the basic idea is to start with the demand curve. What does the demand curve show for a single individual? It shows what quantity of something he would purchase depending on the price. So if this is sugar, and we say this is a price of $3 a pound, and suppose at $3 a pound I wouldn't buy any sugar at all, even if sugar was free, I wouldn't consume an infinite amount of it, we hope, but I don't know, maybe use it as fuel to heat my house or something, the amount is going to tend, the amount I choose to consume, if it's down at a dollar, I will consume, let us say, 2 pounds a week or something like this over here. Zero and so forth. Right? That's what a demand curve shows. It shows quantity you choose to buy as a function of price. The part that isn't obvious is to see that it also shows the value to you. And the reason it shows the value is that the reason why, when sugar was $2 a pound, I bought just this amount
was that that last grain of sugar was worth just about $3 a pound to me. If the last teaspoon of sugar that I bought had been valued to me, by me at more than $2 a pound, then I wouldn't have stopped there. I would have bought some more. If it had been valued by me at less than $2 a pound, I would have said, oops, I'm consuming too much sugar. Better cut my consumption because I'll be better off if I buy less. All right? If you imagine yourself, if you think for a moment of this graph as showing the value to you of a little bit more of what you're buying, you would move out until the value of a little bit more got down to the price of a little more, and then you stop. First teaspoon is worth $3. That only cost me $2. First gram or something, whatever you want. The units to be $3 per pound, because that would be less than $3 per gram. It's a little less than a penny a gram. So the first gram is worth $3 per pound. Next gram is worth a little less. Keep going out until the last gram is worth $2 a pound. That's where I stop. Does that argument make sense to people? Yes? No? But if that's right, then this is not only my demand curve, it's also what we call my marginal value curve, showing how much each little additional bit of sugar is worth to me. And I can then say, well, all right, this first gram was worth $3 a pound, cost me $2 a pound, so I made $1 a pound times the ratio of a gram to a pound, because a gram isn't very much, net gain from buying this. I was better off by the difference between the highest price I would have paid to get it and the price I had to pay. Run that all the way down, and that area shows the benefit to me of being able to buy sugar at $2 a pound. If sugar suddenly vanished from the market, I would be worse off by that area. If the price dropped to $1 a pound, my total gain is now the area above this line. So the increase in my total gain when it drops from $1 from $2 to $1 is going to be that. Argument? All right? So if it's not, it's worth thinking about, because it's sort of, it's one of these things which until you see the answer, it seems like a confusing puzzle. How much better off am I? But it's a pretty straightforward answer. And it turns out that you can make exactly the same argument for producers, you just turn it upside down. Now, as the price goes up, we choose to produce more. Think about it as you're mowing lawns, and the more people are willing to pay you per lawn, the more hours a day you're willing to work. Well, if I was willing to work the first hour for only $5 an hour and I'm being paid $10 an hour for the first hour, my net gain from that job, from that first hour of the job, was $5 value. Right? Payment $10 cost me of my leisure $5. Run that up, and you now have something that looks just like this diagram, except now it's a supply curve, and now it's that area. This is, was paid $10 an hour for this hour, would have done it for $5, so I got a $5 gain, which is this difference. Just add up those across here. So it actually provides you a tool for answering questions like, does a steel tariff make us better or worse off? Or questions like, when the government collects, when the government decides to tax something, apples, how much worse are we, off are we as a result? And the natural wrong answer is to say the amount of money collected by the tax. To say if the government collects $1 million in taxes, we're worse off by $1 million we've paid, better off by whatever the government produces with the money. That's wrong. Because we're worse off not only by $1 million we paid, but also by the fact that at the higher price that the good has due to the tax, we're buying less of it, and so we're losing what our surplus would have been on the stuff we're no longer buying. And that sort of is one of the very simple lessons that comes out of elementary economics. The questions on consumer and producer surplus? No. All right. This is stuff that any of you who ever took an economics course should have learned, but it doesn't follow, even that it was taught, and it certainly doesn't follow that it was learned and still remembered 4 years later or whatever. I'm in general somewhat skeptical of the whole model of education that consists of someone telling you, you're going to know that need this stuff sometime in the future, so learn it now. And I think that when you can do it, a better way of getting educated is say, all right, well, I need this tomorrow. Let me learn it. Because then you're really using it. It matters to you. You can't do everything that way, but it's the right way to do it when you can, in my opinion. Anyway, particular model economists like, because it's a nice, clean, tidy model, is the model of perfect competition.
where there are enough producers and consumers so that each individual can take the price as given, it's the market price, and know that his output won't affect it. It turns out that if you work through the logic of that, as I was saying before, it gives you the perfectly efficient outcome, the outcome which the wise central planner would give you. Why does it do it? If the price of sugar is $2 a pound, then producers will keep producing sugar until the cost to them of that last pound they produce is $2. As long as you can grow a pound of sugar for less than $2, you should grow that pound and let's plant some more. All right. This is, again, assuming you're small enough so that you're not going to affect the price with your output. So that means that in equilibrium, when everybody is maximizing his profits, the cost of producing the last bit of sugar produced is just equal to the price. Similarly, if you're a consumer and you can buy sugar for $2 a pound, as we saw there, you'll keep buying it until the last bit of sugar you get is worth $2 a pound. So what does that mean? It means that every pound of sugar that can be produced for less than it's worth to a consumer is getting produced. And you're producing up to the point where the last pound of sugar costs just as much to produce as it's worth to the consumer. That's the efficient rule. That says as long as it's worth more to somebody than it costs to somebody else, you do it. So that's sort of a very, very simple sketch of what's called the efficiency theorem in economics, which is a lot more elaborate. So the result is basically that in the perfectly competitive model, you just leave it alone and you maximize total surplus. And then there are various reasons why that doesn't describe the whole world, unfortunately. So one of the deviations, the one that's suggested by my definition of perfect competition, is monopoly. That's a case where you have one firm, so it knows that its output does affect prices. And what is a monopoly? As we usually use it, it's a single firm that is producing almost the entire output for a market. Strictly speaking, it should be the entire, but we don't make sharp distinctions between 99% and 100%. There's some ambiguity in there, which we'll get to later, over what a market means. That, after all, Apple Computer has an absolute monopoly of the Macintosh computer model market, but it's a relatively small player in the personal computer model, which also includes inferior machines running Windows or machines running Linux or machines running a variety of other things. Inferior from the standpoint of those of us who prefer Apples, which is the reason why there is a certain sense in which it's a monopoly, because only when the Mac is quite a lot more expensive than the PC will I consider the PC, so in a certain sense, I'm their market, and in that market they have a monopoly, in the wider market they don't. Forget that for the moment, we'll get back to it. So in the case of a monopoly, the monopoly in effect can control either price or quantity, but not both. That they can choose to sell Macintoshes for $3,000 a piece, but they won't sell very many if they do. They can choose to produce, you know, 50 million of these things a year, but if so, they'll sell for a very low price. So they are, in effect, picking what combination of price and quantity on the consumer's demand curve, what quantity determining price or price determining quantities, you may want to think about it, they're going to produce. And then the question is, why is it a monopoly? Why does it exist? Why does this situation happen? One possibility might be that there is some single input that you need to produce something. So if you imagine that there's one pass through the mountain range and I own it, I've got a monopoly of getting from this side of the mountain range to that side of the mountain range. One of the most famous, at least supposed, monopolies in modern times is De Beers' monopoly of the diamond industry. And that's actually quite unclear what's going on. Because in terms of supply of diamonds, De Beers controls, I gather now, about half the total supply. On the other hand, as I understand it, most diamonds at the raw stage are sold through De Beers. And so one possibility which I've seen... What?
Sorry, you know, De Beers?
De Beers is the company.
Is it based in...
It was based in South Africa. I don't know at the moment. I don't know what it's currently... I'm sure it's not based in the U.S., given that it's had various legal problems with the U.S., but I'm not sure what country at the moment it's officially headquarters in. But I'm pretty sure it started out as a South African firm, because South Africa was where the diamonds were mostly being produced at the time. And so it may be that for reasons which I'm not going to go into, a large firm marketing diamonds has big advantages over smaller firms doing it, and therefore De Beers can say to all the independent producers, look, I can get you better prices than if you sell it yourself. So exactly what's going on there is not entirely clear. I want to argue, however, that I'm an example of a much more common sort of monopoly than De Beers is, as is Apple Computer. That is that the common monopoly situation is not you've got a huge market with only one firm, because huge markets usually have room for multiple firms. The common situation is that different people produce different sorts of things. So that if you want a public lecture on law and econ issues from my perspective, I'm the only guy who can do a good job of giving it. And some people want that. Therefore, if I think of my situation as a seller of my services, I'm not in a situation where if I charge $500 for a lecture, I can give as many as I want. And if I charge $600, I'll get none of them. That would be the perfectly competitive model when there's just one price. I'm rather in a situation where if I ask $500, some people will pay that. If I ask 1,000, maybe one or two will pay that. If I'm willing to talk for 100, I can get more speaking engagements. And that's sort of a very common situation any time that what you're selling is not a perfect substitute for what other people are selling. And that's Apple's situation as well. So where does this monopoly come from? One way of looking at it, one kind of it, is what we refer to, what economists refer to as a natural monopoly. And a natural monopoly comes when, for the relevant market, one big firm can produce cheaper than several smaller firms. And that's the typical pattern in sort of physical production, in cars and computers and stuff, is that there is some range of production over which average cost falls as you increase output, because you've got one expenditure on designing your product and making your tools and such, and once you've done that, you can just roll them out. But as firms get bigger, the problems of running firms, the number of layers between the president and the factory floor gets higher and higher, and that introduces administrative diseconomies of scale, ways in which it's harder to run a big firm well than a small firm. So that means that at some point you have, as it were, exhausted the physical economies so that a bigger firm is only a tiny bit cheaper than a pretty big firm, and you're adding the administrative. And the result is that the typical case in most areas is that a firm large enough to produce all of the world's automobiles would lose out in competition to firms a fifth or a tenth the size. On the other hand, a firm large enough to produce all of the talks on law and economics from my perspective that the market wants, that I can exhaust quite comfortably myself, so to speak. And similarly, if you think of your favorite mystery writer is probably not a perfect substitute for any other mystery writer, and so has a narrow kind of monopoly. So a natural monopoly happens if cost keeps going down until you're selling all the market wants to buy, so to speak. And that would be true occasionally for big markets, but not uncommonly for very small markets. Another example would be the only general store in a small town. That would be a nice example of a natural monopoly. It would cost more to have two stores half that size so they can outcompete smaller stores. But they can do that only because it's a fairly small market, whereas if you look around us here, we observe that there are multiple grocery stores within the same general area, and the bigger ones don't, little tiny ones have problems, but bigger ones don't seem a lot cheaper than the smaller ones. Second possibility, and this is one a lot of people think about, although it's of somewhat dubious real-world significance, is an artificial monopoly, meaning the big firm has no advantage in production, but nonetheless undersells everybody else and drives them out of business. And the standard story that people at least used to tell is that, and they used to associate with Standard Oil and John D. Rockefeller, is he's got lots of money, he's a big firm, so he can sell oil below cost, drive out the smaller firms, and then raise up prices as much as he wants. And the problem with this theory, it's sort of a nice example of arguing in words instead of in numbers. And what I mean by that is that when you say Standard Oil has more money, that doesn't tell us how much more money. Let us imagine for a moment that Standard Oil is 10 times, make it 100 times as big as the competitor. It's no more efficient, right? This is not a natural monopoly. So they can produce oil. It was actually kerosene at the time. We think of Standard Oil as gasoline, but at the time of the antitrust hearings, automobiles weren't around yet, so it was kerosene, basically. So the competitor can produce kerosene at the same price per gallon as Standard Oil. Standard Oil says, yeah, but we're richer than you are. We're going to cut so that we're losing 10 cents on every gallon we sell, and we're going to drive you out. But wait a minute. Standard Oil is selling 99 gallons of kerosene for every 1 gallon that the small competitor is selling, which means that Standard Oil has more money, all right, but is losing it 99 times as fast. All right? So on that basis, unless they not only have more money, but more than 99 times as money, they're the ones who go bankrupt. Worse than that. Standard Oil, and you drive the price down, people are going to buy more. In order to hold the price down, Standard Oil's got to sell even more oil below cost of production. Whereas the small competitor can say, well, look, we'll keep producing from our very best factory, but we're going to lay off some of our staff and close down the old factory because at this low price, why should we lose any more money than we have to? So that means that Standard Oil is going to be losing more than in proportion to its share of the market, and that makes it a very expensive procedure. And this argument was made by an economist at University of Chicago Law School about, I don't know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and someone else there by the name of John McGee got curious. And so he looked through the many-volume transcript of the Standard Oil antitrust hearings. And he discovered that there was not a single example there of anybody saying that Standard Oil had driven them out of business by predatory pricing, by cutting price below cost. That as far as you could tell from the transcript, that was pure myth. The closest he came for was the testimony of the president of Corn Planter Oil, which was one of the small companies, which was not driven out of business. And what he said was that Corn Planter was expanding, and a local Standard Oil manager came into his office and said, look, if you guys don't stop expanding and cutting into our market, we're going to cut the price of oil on you and drive you out. And the president of Corn Planter said, you want to do that? I'll ship it for 100 miles around, and I'll make you match the price there. And I couldn't ask a bigger picnic than that. Because, of course, the bigger the area he sells to, the more money Standard is going to have to lose if they want to hold the price down in that area. And he says, I bid him good day, and I never saw them again. And Corn Planter, if you looked at the figures, was worth a lot more by the time the guy testified than at the time of this event. So that, in fact, it prospered. And the general argument, then, is that although you can't really prove that predatory pricing is impossible, because going back to game theory and commitment strategies, if I know that Standard Oil is going to drive me out however much it takes, I'm not going to come in the first place. The argument is only that the large firm is in a weaker position than the small one, because in order to cut prices, it's going to have to lose very much more money because it's selling much more. Rockefeller did buy out some of his competitors, and the trouble with buying out your competitors, of course, is that then they have an incentive to start another refinery and get bought out again, and you've got to buy them out at a good price to get them to sell. And I gather there was one guy who sold 3 successive refineries to Rockefeller. There's a limit to how many refineries Rockefeller can use. Now, I've been getting renewed interest in all of these issues because of my activities on World of Warcraft, where I am Corn Planter Oil, so to speak. That is one of the things I've been doing, is cutting virtual gemstones and selling them on the auction house, competing with people who are selling many more than I have. And as far as I can tell, McGee is in fact correct. My wife actually had, when she was in the same situation on World of Warcraft, received a threatening email, threatening inside the game. The threat was, it wasn't a criminal threat. The threat was basically to undercut her and drive her out, and her reply was, you know, feel free to try. Person gave up very quickly. But I was thinking that if that person had ever sent me a similar message, which unfortunately she didn't, although she's still selling and I'm still competing with the same person my wife is competing with, that I would refer her to the McGee article and see if she read it. But anyway, I found it a lot of fun actually sort of dabbling in these situations in a sense that in one sense is real, even although it's only electrons moving around in computers. But it's human beings behind those electrons, which is what makes online games fun. That part of the reason things like World of Warcraft work is that human beings are much better at pretending to be human beings than computers are. And therefore, a game where the people on the screen you're interacting with are mostly other human beings is a lot more interesting than one in which they're all computers. Anyway, that's it. So in any case, so that's the artificial monopoly. Then there's a third kind of monopoly, which is very common, and that's state monopoly. And that, in fact, was the original meaning, I think, of the term, that the salt monopoly meant not that one company could produce salt cheaper than anybody else, but it meant that the king said, if you will pay me, you know, 1,000 pounds, which I need to build a new palace or pay my troops or something, I will give you the legal monopoly over selling salt in England. And we'll arrest anybody else we find selling salt. And that, and in fact, versions of that are still very common. It is illegal to compete with the post office in delivering first-class mail, and UPS and FedEx have basically found various loopholes in what are called the public express statutes, which let them do things that are theoretically package delivery but don't count as first-class mail. But if they just did straight first-class mail, they'd be in violation of the law. There is a crazy 19th century character who had interesting political views, but who also started his own post office. And if I've got the story right, he had this radical idea about using new technology, and that was the idea of using railroad trains to carry letters, to carry mail, instead of using horses to carry mail and wagons to carry mail. And his American Letter Mail Company was undercutting the post office and succeeding until he, in an excess of what we would call chutzpah, put in a bid to the U.S. government to carry their mail, at which point the post office decided enough is enough and closed him down via the laws against competing with the post office. There are many, not, I don't know how many, but some U.S. states. There is a state liquor monopoly, and it's illegal for you to have a liquor store. Only the state of Pennsylvania is allowed to sell liquor. It used to be the case until airline deregulation under Carter that the airlines were a cartel, which is to say a group of separate firms coordinating as if they were a single monopoly, and the cartel was enforced by the government. Because under the airline regulation, it was illegal for an airline to cut its fares or to raise them, to change them, or to fly new routes without permission from the CAB. And when they put in an application, the other airlines would, of course, explain to the CAB why it wasn't really good for the industry to have a fare war, and therefore they shouldn't be allowed to cut their fares. So those are all examples. Professional licensing, we discussed a little earlier, is really a form of state monopoly. The government is saying, we will control who can be a barber in the city of Chicago and keep down the number and keep up the prices. Patents and copyrights are monopolies granted by the state. There may be arguments for them, but they are, in fact, monopolies in the normal sense. Next question is, what's wrong with monopoly anyway? And of course, as a monopolist, I think monopoly is a fine idea as long as I'm the one doing it. But the economist's answer is essentially, as we'll see in a minute, that a monopoly which acts in the way that maximizes its profits does not produce the result that produces the maximum benefit for all affected, which includes it and its customers. That, as I was saying, the sort of surprising result in perfect competition is that each person acting in his own interest, as Adam Smith put it, is led as by an invisible hand to promote an interest that is no interest of his, so that in the perfectly competitive case, each person maximizing his profit really does, in some sense, maximize combined benefit to everybody else. Get a little bit more into what that means later. It's not true for a monopoly. And the way to see it is, imagine that we have a monopoly, and it has a fixed cost of $1 million a year. However many widgets are produced, it's got to pay $1 million a year to keep its factory open. And then there's an additional cost of $1 per widget for producing widgets. So that means if they produce 1 million widgets a year, their average cost is $2. $1 million for the factory, $1 million for the widget. 2 million divided by 1 million widgets, $2 per widget. If they produce 2 million, now they have a total cost of $3 million. 2 million widgets, $1.50 is the average cost, and so on out to infinity in that simple case. This firm has no administrative diseconomies. It just gets cheaper and cheaper as it gets bigger. What is the price that maximizes their profits? Well, that's not clear. Suppose, just for fun, that they sold it at marginal cost, at the cost of one more widget, which is what competitive firms do end up doing, in fact. But the monopoly, what's going to happen if the monopoly sells at a dollar a widget? It's never going to recover its fixed costs, and it's going to lose $1 million a year. That does not sound like a sensible policy. So therefore, the monopoly, if it starts out thinking about a dollar a widget, is going to imagine higher and higher prices until it finds the price at which its profits maximized. And I don't think, well, formally the way you do it is you say, imagine that we're considering selling one more widget. You know, one more widget per year. To sell one more widget per year, we'll have to cut our prices a tiny, tiny bit. Given how much we could make selling a million widgets a year, how much more or less would we make selling a million in one? A million widgets a year, we would sell it some price, call it $2 a widget. A million in one, we would sell it $1.9999 a widget. Compare those two figures, subtract production costs, what would our what would the result be? As long as we increase revenue by more than we increase cost, we want to produce more. When we reach the point where the increased revenue just matches the increased cost, we better stop. Because one step beyond that, our profits start going down. So your marginal revenue then is the gain from selling one more widget minus the loss from the fact that your price has to drop a little bit to sell one more widget. And you would maximize your profit when your marginal revenue equaled your marginal cost, because that's the point at which the last widget brings in just as much money on net as it costs to produce. And therefore, the marginal revenue is a price. Marginal revenue is lower than price because the amount of money you get selling one more widget is the price minus the reduction due to the fact that you have to sell at a lower price to sell another widget. So therefore, the monopolist maximizes his profit at a price somewhere above marginal cost. And you can draw lines on graphs and figure out where it is if you knew all the costs and things, but we don't need to do that here. On the other hand, if you think about it in terms of the combined effect on buyer and seller, as long as the good is worth more to the buyer than it costs the seller to produce, you ought to produce it. So that means that the efficient quantity is to charge a price equal to marginal cost. People will then buy it until the value of the next one to them goes down to marginal cost. You're now producing everything worth producing. And so that argument tells us that the monopoly does not, although the perfect competition does, produce the optimal quantity, the quantity that maximizes total benefit to all concerned. And that, oddly enough, is what economists mean when they say monopolies are inefficient. And it's one of these many cases when, because we use the same English language as everybody else, people think they understand it when they don't. And you say monopoly is inefficient, and people say, oh yeah, they're fat and lazy and don't do a good job of running their factories. That's not what it says at all. We say, no, assume that they're lean and clever and smart, and they're maximizing their profits like everybody wants to do. Results inefficient. Because the result gives a benefit to them, but a cost to the rest of us that's larger than the benefit to them. So therefore, what's wrong with monopoly is that it maximizes its profit at a price higher than the price that would maximize the net benefit to the customer and the firm. And that's the usual economic argument about inefficiency. There's a second inefficiency which is not part of the standard textbooks. It was originally pointed out by Gordon Tullock, and who was a somewhat crazy and very innovative guy who used to be a colleague of mine. And his argument is an argument about what economists call rent-seeking. And let's imagine the following story. Imagine that somewhere out west, beyond where people have settled very much, there's a valley. And it's a nice, rich valley, and once the settlement gets out there, it's going to be a place that will produce lots of grain that will need railroads to transport to the East Coast to sell. And I say to myself, you know, if I were to buy the land and build a railroad into this valley, that's my railroad, I would have a monopoly. Because given the fixed cost of building a railroad, it would never pay anybody else to build a second railroad running next to my railroad. Question is, when should I build this railroad? And let us suppose that just at the moment there is no revenue at all to be made from that, because there's nobody there yet. And given the costs of building a railroad and paying interest on the bonds and maintaining the railroad and keeping Indians from turning the rails into knives or something, I figure that I will lose $100,000 a year for each year up to the point where the valley is settled. But on the other hand, once the valley is settled, to make life easy, it's going to be settled in an instant. There's going to be a day when they open it up for settlement and everybody comes in, grains jumps out of the ground and starts loading onto my freight cars to go to the port of New York. And I say, the value to me of this monopoly, my monopoly profit summed, you know, present value summed forever, is going to be $5 million.
So I say, if I had the monopoly, it would be worth $5 million. So what's the obvious thing to do? The obvious thing to do is to wait until the year before they settle it, build my railroad, lose $100,000 or whatever it is during, while I'm waiting for the settlers, maybe a little less if I have a little closer, then make $5 million. What happens if I try to do that?
Somebody's going to go in railroad.
Obviously, someone else would also like $5 million, so someone's already got the railroad, so I don't have my monopoly. And if you think about it, as long as anyone is planning to build the railroad less than 50 years before the settlement, someone else will build it earlier because $500,000 is better than nothing.
Right.
So is $400,000, so is $300,000. So Tulloch's argument, this is what we call rent seeking, and Tulloch's argument was that the existence of a monopoly, if there were ways of spending money to make sure that you were the monopoly, as in my hypothetical case, because of the monopoly profits, there will be an incentive to spend more money trying to compete to become the monopoly. And that's going to use up resources, what we call rent-seeking, and therefore represents a second expense due to monopolies. So, in any case, these are sort of the standard arguments. The conclusion of all of this is that if you have a natural monopoly, if you have a case where indeed it is cheaper for one big firm to produce than lots of smaller firms, or even a few smaller firms, you really don't have any very good solutions. That one solution is government monopoly like the post office, and the problem with that is that there's no particular reason why the people running the post office, any more than the private monopolist, will follow those policies that maximize social benefit. That the people running the post office have no particular reason to charge marginal cost, and they have less reason than a private monopolist to hold down expenses, because after all, the more money flows through your hands, the more subordinates you have, the better you can have employees who will work for your political patrons come election time, in a variety of other ways, the ways in which you can get benefit. So it's not clear there's any particular reason to expect government monopoly to do the right thing. Another solution that's very popular is regulated monopoly, things like public utilities. You can't run a regulated monopoly and tell it to charge marginal cost unless you subsidize it, because at marginal cost it never covers its fixed costs and goes broke, and then you don't have the service. But what the standard rule is to try to make a utility charge a price that represents its average cost. That's what's called a rate of return regulation, meaning they're supposed to be charging a price at which they get an ordinary rate of return on their investment. We figure the use of capital is one of their costs. First problem is, how do you find out what average cost is? If average cost is measured by what they actually spend, then again, there's no incentive to hold down expenditure, because if we spend more money on a nice office for the president of the company, we get to charge a higher price to get that money back. If you say, well, the average cost is what it ought to be, then the problem is, how does the regulator figure out how much it should cost? And there's actually some early research by George Stigler and Claire Friedland where they looked at regulation of electric utilities when it was first coming in. So you had some states where it's regulated and some non-regulated, and as far as they could tell, it had no effect at all. I think prices and profits and such were about the same, regulated or unregulated. And again, we have the usual problem of all of this assumes the regulator is trying to do the right job, but how do we make it in his interest to maximize social benefits? Same problem as for anyone else. So neither of those is a very good solution, and we've already seen that unregulated monopoly results in an inefficient outcome and may result in wasteful rent-seeking. On the other hand, there are two advantages over the other two. The first is, at least they want to minimize costs, because those costs are coming out of the pockets of whoever owns the monopoly. And second, if it's really an unregulated monopoly, then it can't use the force of government to stay a monopoly. That in the world as we know it, things change. The same industry that's a natural monopoly this decade may find that some new competitors are appearing next decade. And private firm, all it can do is try to compete. A government monopoly can say, sorry, you're not allowed to do that because you're competing with us and we're the legal monopoly. Standard example for this would be the Interstate Commerce Commission, that there were certainly elements of monopoly in the 19th century railroads.
The ICC was set up to regulate it. It then expanded to regulate the barge industry. Barges are competitive. There's no particular advantage to running 500 barges instead of one, but barges compete with railroads. And since they were regulating the railroads, they had to have regulation of the barges. And then later, the trucking industry. Trucking industry is a competitive industry. It's no huge advantage to having a fleet of 5,000 trucks instead of a 50. And yet the ICC regulated them, controlled entry and rates. Why? Because they were competing with the people they were already regulating. So, in a sense, the disadvantage of getting the government involved is that if the regulation is controlled by the industry, which it often is, because they're the people with the biggest stake in it, that then they can use it to, as it were, prolong their monopoly beyond its natural life. Right. What about unnatural monopoly? What about cases where you don't have a where smaller firms can do as well? Then you have an argument against government-created monopoly because the single firm will be inefficient for the usual reasons. But you also have an argument against the situation where one firm buys out the others. If it's an industry where it takes a long time to get started, for a while they have a monopoly and could raise prices. And the theory of the antitrust division is that it tries to prohibit mergers that are designed to create a monopoly and raise prices. And that, I don't know if I discussed with you or my other class, the problem of how does the antitrust division distinguish between a merger designed to create a monopoly and raise prices and a merger designed to take advantage of the fact that the two firms have complementary abilities and can do a better job of producing if they combine. And old friend of mine at UC Irvine had a very elegant solution to this problem. The way you figure out whether to permit a merger is you ask the competitors. You ask the other firms in the industry. And if the other firms in the industry tell you to permit the merger, you forbid it. And if they tell you to forbid the merger, you permit it. Clear why? If what we're doing is creating a monopoly and we're going to restrict output and raise prices, that's just wonderful for the small firms that are left, because they'll be able to sell at the large high prices without restricting it. If what we're doing, on the other hand, is creating a firm that can produce better goods cheaper, now the other firms in the industry won't want it. So this depends, of course, on nobody knowing that's what the antitrust division is doing. But I still thought it was sort of an elegant solution for finding out who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. Let me go on to talk about price discrimination, because that's sort of economically and legally interesting thing. Discrimination sounds like a bad thing unless you say, well, you know, he's pretty undiscriminating. That sounds like a negative thing about him. But I want to look at price discrimination for the moment from the standpoint of the monopolist. Speaking as a monopolist, I'm in favor of price discrimination. And I want to consider how it looks for the monopolist. And the monopolist says, well, you people are complaining that what I'm doing is inefficient. Why? Because there are people out there who value my widgets at $1.50 and they only cost me $1 to produce, but my profit maximizing price is $2, so there are people out there who value my widgets at $1.50 and aren't getting them. And that's wasteful. And I agree. That's really a sad situation. Because just think, I could be making 50 cents a widget out of those people. If I could only find a way of identifying the guys who will pay only $1.50 and selling widgets to them for $1.50 to everybody else for $2, I got my profit here and another 50 cents per person there. So you're right. Inefficiency is a bad thing and I got to do something about it. And then what I have to do is to find some way either of charging different prices to different customers or of charging different prices to the same customer for different units. And my standard example from a price theory book I wrote a long time ago was the cookie company. And the cookie company has identical customers, and it's got a marginal cost of 10 cents per cookie. And we could start out, we could get a little bit filled up, but we could start out, here's the identical customer's demand curve, and at 10 cents a cookie, here's what he would buy, but of course I'm not going to sell it at 10 cents a cookie because that's my marginal cost. Well, what could I do? What if I say to my customers, look, our normal price for cookies, as you know, is 20 cents a cookie. And at 20 cents a cookie, you'll buy 5 cookies a week. But
I'm a generous guy. I think people ought to eat cookies. So I've got this deal for you. That if you buy 5 cookies a week, any cookies beyond that, only 15 cents a piece. All right, so the result is that I make this much out of those, and then I make that much extra out of selling another 4 cookies a week at a price below my 20 cents for the loan cost. Right. So what have I done? I've increased my profit. My stockholders are happy. And I've also made what I'm doing less inefficient, because now at least some of the people, some of the units, people value it more than cost of production. And that's pretty good. That's a pretty good system. But I ought to be able to do better than that. Because, as you can see, I'm still missing two things. First, there's some other people here, people think even more, if I cut my price a little more, or other units, these are all, this is one, think of this as one person and I've got 10,000 identical people. So it's how many cookies that person chooses to buy. So from one standpoint, but in addition, how come my customers who don't do any work at all making cookies, they're getting some consumer surplus up here, getting some consumer, and I don't want to be mine. I'm the one who makes cookies, after all, why should they be the ones who get anything valuable? It seems only fair to me that I'm the one who gets the benefits. Some wise man suggested a long time ago that everybody is a biased judge in his own case, and that applies to manufacturers of cookies as well as applies to everybody else. So we have the question then is, how can I make sure that I am fairly rewarded for my public interest activity in producing lots and lots of cookies? And there is a simple and elegant solution to this problem. Let me make sure I do not get this onto my shirt. I have a different problem. And the solution is the invention of the Cookie Club. And the Cookie Club is a public spirited enterprise. If you are a member of the Cookie Club, we will sell you cookies at 10 cents per cookie. This is a deal. But of course, we can't have just everybody in the Cookie Club. So we're going to have an entry fee. And the entry fee is a per week charge, which by an odd coincidence equals the consumer surplus you would get from getting cookies at 10 cents a cookie. So what I've just done is to maximize the sum of producer and consumer surplus, which I do by selling at marginal cost, then transfer all the consumer surplus back to me by making an entrance fee in which you are paying for the opportunity to buy my 10 cent cookies, an amount equal to the value you would have that opportunity. All right? And that's what's called two-part pricing. And if done perfectly, the result is that we eliminate the inefficiency. Everybody's getting cookies and values for 10 cents. And at the same time, from my standpoint as the public spirited baker of cookies, we eliminate this unfair and unjust result in which lots of my efforts are going to benefit my worthless customers instead of benefiting me the way I want. Now, there's a practical problem, and that is that I've assumed throughout that my customers are identical. And if the customers actually have different demand curves for cookies, then I can't do this well, because if I have a price that equals all of one customer's consumer surplus, it's going to be above the consumer surplus of the second customer, so we won't buy any cookies because he won't join the club, below the consumer surplus of another, so he's getting some and I'm getting some. So the perfect price discrimination does require, done in that way, identical customers, and you can only do it imperfectly. But there are other ways. The other problem I mentioned up there is resale, that I know you're a nice guy, and you're basically honest, but I can't believe that you're really eating 500 cookies a week. And, of course, you're not eating 500 cookies a week. You're only eating the 11 cookies a week that the demand curve shows, but as soon as you go out of my store with your big sack of cookies, you set up a little table by the and say, cookies, 15 cents a piece. And you then sell all those cookies, and funny, oddly enough, nobody will buy my cookie club, because they're buying the cookies from you and you're only paying one membership, not 1,000 memberships. Right? So you've got to have some way of preventing resale. And that's one reason why price discrimination tends to work better for goods of a sort that are consumed on the seller's premises. Transportation, for example. That you can't,
If you think of price discrimination, suppose my price discrimination is that I give cheap airline fares to students, which is something that's sometimes been done, or to young people. Well, it doesn't do any good for the young person to buy the ticket in order that the rich, that his rich uncle, who would be charged a high price, can fly, because his rich uncle doesn't have the right identification to claim to be that young person. Similarly, it does no good for Rockefeller's chauffeur to get an expensive medical operation for Rockefeller, because Rockefeller wants that operation for himself. So that works better for things that are consumed, as it were, under the eye of the producer than for things that are sold and could be resold. But there are a variety of other ways you can do price discrimination. And many of them involve discriminating not across units, but across people. So the sort of standard example that I like to give is the story, no doubt apocryphal, of the optometrist who's finished doing the eye measurements, and the customer says, well, how much are these glasses going to cost? And the optometrist says, well, cost $100. And customer doesn't wince. That's for the frames, of course. Still doesn't wince. The lenses are $50. Still doesn't wince. Each. All right, that's a version of price discrimination in which you're trying, by watching your customer, to figure out how high a price you can get away with charging him. Other ways, though, let me give you a real example. Bain Books is a publisher of science fiction and fantasy, which is distinguished by being the only publisher I know of that viewed the internet as an opportunity rather than a threat. And one of the things Bain used to do, and I think still does, is that when you publish a book with Bain, they offer for sale as electronic editions the book before it's available, before it's been printed. They offer what are referred to as author's review copies, which are, if you actually publish a book, you want reviews to appear in magazines and things when the book comes out, which means you've got to get copies to reviewers before there are copies to give them. And so you print up what's basically a bound set of proofs that looks like a sort of a cheap book, and you send that out to everybody you hope will review the book. And what Bain does is to take the electronic equivalent of that and offer it for sale. And the earlier you buy it, the more you pay. So if there's a new book coming out by your favorite author, and you wait till it's actually out, you can buy the electronic version for, say, $10, or you can buy the publisher version for $10. If you want to beat all your friends and read it a month earlier, it's $15 for their friend. 2 months earlier, $20. So that's sort of an interesting case of real-world price discrimination. It doesn't cost Bain any more to send you the copy 2 months earlier than 1 month earlier, but it's worth more to you. But what about ordinary physical stuff? What sort of price discrimination do you think ordinary publishers of ordinary books engage in? How do we sell the same book for two different prices? One of them a high price to people who really like it, and the other a...
Change currencies?
I'm not sure how that will let you sell it to...
Hardcover
and paperback is what I was thinking of. That if you really like it, you want the hardcover. Also, many books, the book comes out first in hardcover, so if you're an enthusiastic fan, you don't want to have to wait. If you're just sort of a casual reader, you buy it later in paperback. The different countries is a different issue, and that is if you believe that Americans are, on the whole, willing to pay higher prices than Englishmen because Americans are richer than English on average. So you bring out an American edition and an English edition, and the American edition is more expensive, the English edition is less expensive, and you attempt to use legal ways of forbidding the people who put out the English edition or who buy the English edition from shipping copies to America and underselling your American edition. All right, so these are all examples of price discrimination. And as I say, we're used to thinking of discrimination as a bad thing, but that's really wrong. Discrimination just means distinguishing between things that can be good or bad depending on, you know, why you're doing it. That, you know, we hope, after all of you hope, that the law firms that are employing people will discriminate against students who have got, between students who have gotten a good legal education at Santa Clara and students who have gotten an inferior legal education at some competing school. That's a form of discrimination. And if you believe you're really good, you hope they're very discriminating about identifying the really good people and offering them lots of money. So question then is, should we think of price discrimination as good or bad? And the answer is yes. That it could be both. that on the one hand, perfect price discrimination eliminates the inefficiency I started with because now everybody who values the good at least marginal cost gets it. That's a gain. On the other hand, if there is a possibility for rent seeking, it increases the monopoly profit and thus the amount wasted trying to get the monopoly. Imperfect price discrimination, which is much more typical, which is things like hardcover, soft cover, special rates for young people, the different prices in different countries, that eliminates some of the inefficiency because you're trying to charge a low price to people who only pay a low price. But on the other hand, since you're charging different prices in different places, you're not allocating the good to whoever values it most, and you might have a case where the good goes, where one copy of the book goes to an Englishman who values it at $11 instead of an American who values it at $19 because we're selling it for $10 in England and $20 in America. So the basic bottom line, if you work out the economics, is that according to how you set up your situation, permitting price discrimination might result in a more efficient or might result in a less efficient outcome. That's not a very, in a sense, it's an unsatisfactory result, but it happens to be the truth about the economics of price discrimination. All right, let me go on to talk about another dimension of this whole area of imperfect competition, and that's oligopolies and cartels. So an oligopoly is what's not quite a monopoly. The oligopoly happens when a firm has to be very large to be competitive because what they're doing requires large-scale production, but not doesn't have to be large enough to be the whole market. So if you imagine that there are five firms in a particular industry, the automobile industry is an oligopoly, sort of very classic oligopoly, that it's very hard to start a firm producing only 10,000 cars a year and compete. But, on the other hand, it's not one firm. GM, even when it was the biggest, wasn't able to outcompete Ford and whoever else was in the business at the time. And, of course, there are more firms if you allow for the world market, which we nowadays have to do. So the question is, what happens when there are only a few firms? And one possible way of understanding it, we discussed earlier, was Nash equilibrium, where you could say, well, each firm decides what price to charge, what quantity to produce, knowing that the more it produces, the lower the price it's going to be able to get. Each firm, they sort of jockey around trying out price-quantity combinations until they get to a point where each one says, given what the other firms are doing, this is what maximizes my profit. And it turns out, as I may have discussed before, that just how that works out depends a lot on what you assume about how each one assumes the other ones are acting. But an alternative, and a much more attractive alternative if you're one of the firms, is to say, why should we compete with each other? Look, we're all good people in the business of producing automobiles. Automobiles are vital for the national interest of America, that Americans can get to their jobs and to their houses. We need a healthy automobile industry. And how can we have a healthy automobile industry if we keep competing and cutting prices? So let's have a gentleman's agreement, all right? We know what price we sold all our cars for last year. How about each of us raises prices 10% next year and reduces output by however much we need to do in order to keep that price up? Right. That's a cartel. That's a group of firms which, although they're separate firms, agree to act as if they were a single monopoly, reducing output and driving up prices. And doing that in the U.S. at the moment is illegal, violation of the antitrust laws. Even if it were legal, as long as it's not enforceable, as long as the agreement to by which my firm says I'll hold down my quantity if you hold down your quantity, what's called a contract and restraint of trade, as long as that's unenforceable, it is very hard, though not impossible, to make it work. Because the problem is that each firm in the cartel wants the others to hold down output. But each firm would like itself as unobtrusively as possible to either increase output, which might mean as unobtrusively as possible to cut its prices, to sort of call in the guy from Hertz, because Hertz is one big customer, and say, well, look, we've agreed with our buddies that we'll sell these cars for $30,000, but Hertz will get a quantity discount, and you could have them for $23,000, but don't tell anybody. All right? And in various ways, what's referred to as chiseling, which is a negative term used by other cartel members, but it's a good thing for the customers, the firms have an incentive to try to undercut the agreement. And the result is that it's quite difficult to maintain a cartel without some legal form of enforcement. There's a book called Railroads and Regulation, old book, which looks at the history of railroad regulation. And by his account, prior to the ICC, there were many attempts to form railroad cartels, and almost all of them broke down within a few months. He describes one successful cartel in the southeast, but that mostly everybody would agree, they'd all go back to their office, they'd say, well, all those other guys are going to raise their rates, how can we make money out of this? And then try discrete ways of cutting rates, or not raising rates. The agreements are sometimes enforceable. As far as I can tell, in England, up to about World War I or maybe a little later, they did not interpret the common law as forbidding such contracts, and thus I remember reading at least one case from somewhere around World War I where an English court found enforceable an agreement of this sort. And you can make the agreement in many ways. One standard way is to have a common selling agency. So we say, we'll all produce cars, but they'll all be sold through one extra firm that we all own shares in, and that firm will decide how many to sell at what price and maximize our profits. One more interesting case, and one which you might argue is more realistic than any of the others, is monopolistic competition. And monopolistic competition is the case of that I was mentioning earlier of Apple. It's the case where you've got multiple firms, but they aren't producing identical goods. So the goods are substitutes, but not perfect substitutes. And therefore, one way I've seen it modeled, which I think is a nice way of sort of thinking about the situation, is the street of barters. All right, let's imagine we have a street here, and along the street there are some barbershops. And this is a residential district, so there are customers living along the street too. And if these two barbershops charge the same price and give equally good haircuts, what's going to happen in terms of the customers? Which customers is it going to get? That's right. So at equal prices, these people are all going that way and these people are all going this way. Alright? So that's a nice way of thinking of varying characteristics. The characteristics is where are we located along this line, and therefore how close are we to the customer. So that the equivalent for the computer industry would be that this is Apple. Here are a bunch of people like me who really like Apple computers. And then over here is Windows and Linux and maybe a few other things. And customers at equal prices, all of these people buy Apples. But if Apple is expensive enough, some of the people here say, well, I'm going to go to Linux. Or some people here say, I'm going to go to Windows. Okay? So that means that if you're Apple, in one sense, it looks as though you're a monopoly, because you say, look, if I raise my prices, I don't lose everybody. I lose some people, but just like a monopoly, higher price, fewer sales. The difference, though, is that in the monopolistic competition, somebody can start a new barbershop. If the equilibrium has monopoly profit, if barbershops are making substantially more money than other enterprises, someone will start a new barbershop. And as they start new barbershops, that drives down the return from all the other barbershops, so you have an equilibrium in which, just as in perfect competition, prices are driven down ultimately to costs, so that you have no monopoly profit left, but on the other hand, each individual firm is still setting its prices for a monopoly. So that's sort of an interesting model if you think about the fact that in many areas, goods aren't perfect substitutes. I mean, grain pretty much is, but computers aren't. Cameras sort of so-so. Cars sort of. But, you know, if you own a Jaguar, you don't think that anybody else is a perfect substitute for it, and so forth. All right. Let me now start on another big subject. Maybe the biggest, I suppose, in a certain sense. And that's the idea of externalities, which are another... Well, I started out by saying that in the simple perfect competition model, everything works perfectly, and therefore you want to look at where that model breaks down in order to see where the problems are that, among other things, involve legal attempts at solutions. I've been mostly talking about where the model of an infinite... of every firm being small breaks down. But a different part of the model is that if I want one of your resources in order to do what I want to do, I've got to have your permission. Well, what if the resource in question is clean air? What if you have a house, you like breathing the air? I've got a factory. I like putting smoke out my smokestacks. That's a case in which, absent any legal restrictions, I can impose a cost on you in my production without having your consent. So therefore, whereas if the cost I want to impose on you is you've got to spend a certain number of hours of time working, making cars for me, I can only get you to do that if I offer you a wage you're willing to work at. But if the cost I want to impose on you is the air that you're breathing isn't so clean, if there are no legal restrictions, I can do that without your permission. Therefore, in deciding what to do, I'm going to ignore those costs because they aren't costs to me. So if you think about the sort of simple market solution to the coordination problem, it's a system where everybody bears the costs of his own actions, where any inputs I use, I get with the consent of their owners, so I've got to pay at least their value to the owners. Any outputs that I produce, I can sell to the people who want them for what they're worth to them. Therefore, I end up producing things if the value to the people who get them is more than the cost to the people who I need to produce them and not producing them. Otherwise, sounds like a great way of getting the right answer to the coordination problem, produce goods if they're worth producing and not. But once there are externalities, that system breaks down. Because I say, well, look, what is the cost of producing my steel? Costs $50 a ton, so if people will pay me anything over $50 a ton, I'll give them steel. But I'm ignoring the fact that in addition to $50 a ton for steel workers and ore and coal and whatever else I use, there's another $50 a ton, which is the cost of the air pollution that I'm imposing on my neighbors. So the real cost of my steel is not $50 a ton, but $100 a ton. And when I sell it to somebody who's only willing to pay $60, I'm better off by $10 a ton and the world is worse off by $40 a ton. That argument makes sense? So what it's basically saying is if you don't have externalities and don't have a few other problems, individuals acting in their own interests solve our problem. Great world, but where you do, you have to think about how you deal with it. All right? So, and again, notice the problem is not that air pollution is bad, because all the costs are bad. You know, my workers would rather be sitting at home reading a book, too. The point is that air pollution is a bad that the guy producing it doesn't have to pay for, and therefore does not take it into account in deciding what it's worth doing. I mean, all of our lives we're balancing costs and benefits. The problem occurs when I get the benefit and you get the cost, and then the balancing is not going to come out very well. This is somebody's comment about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I think a couple of years before the collapse, that I think it may have been Larry Summers, someone prominent, who said that the way they had reformed it amounted to privatizing profits and socializing losses. And that does not result in sensible decisions. So where externalities exist, let me give you sort of the very short version of the three approaches to dealing with them, all of which have problems, as you would expect. The first and most obvious one is direct regulation. So the government says to my steel mill, here are the rules. We have decided that we're going to have to allow you to put out some pollution because we need steel for doing stuff, but we think you ought to be able to produce your steel with less pollution, so you must have a 100-foot high chimney because that way more of the pollution gets away from people, and you've got to put in the following kind of filters in your chimney so as to scrub out at least a good deal of the pollution. That would be a regulatory answer. And in effect, what the government is supposed to be doing is deciding what's the level of pollution control that's worth having, what's the efficient level, and ordering me to do it. Second, subtler solution is the government says, we don't know what the efficient level is. All we know is that every ton of sulfur dioxide that comes out of your smokestack does $1,000 worth of damage to people. You can produce as much sulfur dioxide as you like, but the bill is $1,000 a ton. Now you decide how much it's worth cutting it down. All right. So the idea to that solution to externalities is you say, impose the cost on the person who's producing it and let him then decide the trade-off between expensive ways of reducing it and the expense of producing it. And I should say externalities. I've been discussing negative externalities, but there are positive externalities too. Maybe what comes out of my smokestack smells like perfume and everybody loves having it. There, the problem is I wouldn't produce enough of it because I'm not getting the benefit. You can think of other examples of more plausible examples of positive externalities. And then the final approach, which is associated with Ronald Coase, who we've mentioned before, is the legal system defines who has the right to do what, and then individuals transact to get the efficient outcome. So in that world, if the legal system says that I'm allowed to put smoke out, my neighbors downwind come to me and say, look, we'll pay for the scrubber. If the legal system says I'm not allowed to put smoke out without permission of my neighbors downwind, I go to my neighbors downwind and I say, look, how much would I have to pay you to give me permission to pollute so I won't have to pay all this money for scrubbers and higher smokestack? We bargained it out, and if it's worth, you know, if the cost of pollution control is more than the damage done, then there's some price you're willing to accept, and if the cost is less, then the other way. So we'll go into more detail next time, but that's sort of the Coasean approach to these issues. All right, any questions? No. We're finished. Have a nice day.